resents it. So the body subconsciously reflects itself as a victim. Right. And therefore, all activities in the 80s are heroically expressed by somebody in a wheelchair, a damaged body.
Right.
And now we have the new Einstein, the new pink paradigm shaper, Stephen Hawking, on the cover waving at us from his remote-controlled wheelchair. Right. So what's the hidden ground
even,
there?
Since he's unable to talk now, his voice is computer-generated, which is... So his voice is totally discarnate.
Yeah, and they complained about Dr. Beter and organic robotoids. You know, I mean, what about this?
Right.
So, Stephen, look, if you want to get some real new science that isn't pink controlled, you go up to the Metro Library at Bloor and Young.
Right.
Okay. You go up to the third floor in the social studies section and ask for the magazine called The Campaigner.
Right.
And it's in the stacks, and you ask for volumes 73 to 1980, and you'll read about the real physics that are happening that British intelligence won't let you have access to.
Can you tell me, for example, a bit of this?
Well, let's see if Doug can
say
something.
Like, what's my appetite, so to speak?
I haven't gone up there to read it.
Doug didn't go.
Okay.
I don't know how to explain it. Let me just see. Doug, whistle to him for a minute. I'll just get something.
Okay, of course, Bob, when Bob does show up, he has his briefcase.
Right.
And,
What do you mean by pink? Like,
if it's the first time you're listening to the show, pink is, if you know anything about the Church of the Subgenius, pink is the term used to describe the people who are trying to cut off your slack.
My slack?
Your slack. Which, I mean...
Not your slacks.
Not your slacks, right. Your slack.
That's what I was thinking.
Now, what slack is, we've gone into many times, and slack is definitely not happiness.
Oh, okay.
But it's... Okay. I mean, happiness can be part of slack, but happiness is not the be-all, end-all of slack.
Right.
Slack, Bob is the foremost proponent of slack and has the most slack of anyone
that you'll meet,
that you'll ever meet
in your lifetime.
Okay. And now Connie, his wife,
also
has slack.
Slack.
Okay. And she's well known for having
she's
slack
well
in a public,
slack,
in a pink
to
way.
Give other people slack
so is this a
in
verb?
The pink medium.
Yeah.
This is a verb. A verb. The word slack.
That's a good question. Is slack a verb or a noun?
Yeah.
Bucky Fuller said, I seem to be a verb.
Yeah.
But he was more of a 19th century person than Marshall McLuhan. And McLuhan said there were no nouns, just processes.
Right.
I think we could tend towards it being both, like since we're talking physics, the wave and the particle becomes a wavicle.
Right.
Now, these are figures for situation. So in simple terms, situational ethics, relate that to reality, situational realities.
Right.
Bob is a noun in some cases,
mm-hmm.
in this case right now when I'm hogging the microphone.
Right.
In other cases, other grounds,
mm-hmm.
he is a process.
Right.
So he's both, and it depends on what medium he's using.
Right.
In this case, I'm a process because I'm under electric conditions. When you read The Perfect Pitch or read some of my writings, then I'm a noun because that's a visual space. It will create the effect of an object.
Right. Okay.
I have a question, though.
That makes sense.
I have a question of the caller.
Yeah, go ahead.
How long have you been listening to this station?
The station?
Yeah.
I'd say about a year or so, but not day after day. It's usually once every, like, 2 weeks or on an off chance. I usually don't listen to the radio that much. I just usually listen to my tapes a lot.
I see. Are you a student or...
Yes, I am.
You are. Here at Ryerson?
No, at OCA.
Okay.
Yeah.
Just a little listener survey for myself, Bob.
Oh, no problem.
Okay, Doug, let me just get... I'm going to answer the person's question about the alternative to Einstein.
Right.
I'll read you from Bob's files.
Yeah.
Okay. Here's something that Bob said to the Secret Council 10 meeting several years ago.
Yeah.
He said, now, the professional physicist, or the pink, will tell you that there are certain basic parameters which underlie every process which occurs in the universe, no matter what it is. Okay? These include such things as the speed of light,
mm-hmm.
the Planck quantum of action, the charge of the electron, the so-called fine structure constant, and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
If any of these basic parameters were to change, then everything will change. For example, the propagation of sound involves interactions between air molecules, which are complex quantum magnetic configurations,
mm-hmm.
and thus involves all the fundamental parameters of physics.
Mm-hmm.
However, this is a clumsy, somewhat misleading way to state it. Now, this is what I'm saying according to these files and minutes of the meeting several years ago.
Right.
Now, I'm going to say, in reality, and what I mean by that is in slack terms,
mm-hmm.
the so-called fundamental parameters only reflect the fact that physical space-time has a certain curvature
right.
and overall geometry,
right.
such that every process in the universe is shaped accordingly. That's implying shaping a ground, a figure-ground relationship, which I was just explaining to you about the noun and verb.
Right. Right.
Okay, the study of this question in mathematical physics goes back to Nicholas of Cusa,
mm-hmm.
that's about 1500, mm-hmm. and to the 19th century work of Gauss, Riemann, and the Italian geometer Eugenio Beltrami.
Right.
Now, of course, we do not see, I was saying, speaking for the subgeniuses, we do not see this curvature directly. We do not see it.
Mm-hmm.
That is the proper business of science to discover. But by way of a metaphor, think of drawing forms on the surface of a sphere.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, the old Pinkaway image was a pyramid.
Mm-hmm.
The subgenius icon is a sphere. So we draw forms on the surface of a sphere. You can draw any form you want, but as long as it is drawn on a spherical surface, the form will be curved in a certain way,
mm-hmm.
independent of its particular shape. It inherits, in quotes, it inherits the curvature of the sphere upon which it is drawn. Now, the curvature of the universe is different from the static kind of curvature a sphere possesses.
Right.
Okay. However, because the universe's curvature embraces space and time together,
right.
it shapes all processes, from those of human mind down through the domain of living organisms and the inorganic domain from astrophysics into the microscopic subatomic level.
Right.
Since the creative powers of the human mind, slack-inducing making, that's what I add, as realized in scientific and technological progress, our inventions, our man-made artifacts, since the creative powers of the human mind are realized in those manifestations, and they embody most directly the causal principle of the universe, it is the lawful characteristics of creative mentation which most clearly demonstrate the curvature of physical space-time.
Right.
An exciting implication is that something congruent to creative mentation must pervade the whole universe,
yeah.
including the inorganic domain.
Mm-hmm.
And this is called not entropy, but negentropy.
Mm-hmm.
All right? So that is a beginning. And then I would say, in terms of the visible and the invisible, Riemann set this up. He said the real unseen universe is a continuous manifold. It's continuous, the unseen.
Mm-hmm.
The images of processes in that real world, the continuous manifold, are projected as visible events of sense perception into a distorted spherical mirror, such that we see the continuous manifold projected onto that mirror in the form of apparently discrete objects moving about in empty Euclidean space. That's the way it appears. This mirror, called the discrete manifold, is a subsumed feature of the continuous manifold, and exists as if it were a mirror everywhere embedded within the subsuming continuous manifold. And the simplest analogy best used to introduce such notions of projection to students in subgenia is to imagine certain kinds of three-dimensional moving geometrical figures projected onto two dimensions.
Mm-hmm.
The projection of the intersection of two spirals on respective cones, as the cones rotate with respect to one another at different rates, is the simplest demonstration of the notion of generation of projected images of points moving about in two-dimensional space, which was the discrete manifold, by a continuous function in three-dimensional space. Okay, now that's, you intuited that meant something.
Yeah.
Okay?
Yeah.
And that's why I tell you to go to the library to pursue a little deeper. I don't expect you to fully get that, but I assure you this is not the kind of process that the Aristotelian positivist quantum physicist gang coming out of British intelligence, who have dominated the pink scientific reality of the 20th century, are into. They are into nouns. They are into naming. Even though they talk about the post-naming process, they're still trying to name that process.
Yes.
And as you see, this physical model relates right back into your own creative processes and makes you responsible for making your own universe.
You're suggesting the point, a point between subjectivity and objectivity.
Yeah, and those two terms, we have all these dialectical terms
right.
that are misleading right. to the process that I was trying to describe.
Right.
It's not a dialectic.
Would you suggest then that there really isn't a division? It's, there's really a wholeness, but one of the aspects of these people is to divide
No, that's too simple.
It's too simple.
Because when you use visual space, division is the consequent.
Right.
It's always the ground of what you're doing determines the way you go about it and the kinds of notions you come up with.
Right.
So division, there's nothing wrong with division. It's just that it's an effect of visual space. Acoustic space can't be divided.
Right. Okay.
And then tactile space is a whole other thing. So that's a beginning seminar for a virgin subgenius like yourself. Listen, we got some other callers.
Yeah.
If this person is unfriendly or hostile, we'll get rid of them quickly. You call back and we can continue, right?
Okay.
Because we welcome as long as possible, but we got other people waiting on the line.
I understand.
So keep listening and maybe get a chance to talk later tonight again.
Hopefully learn something.
No, don't want to learn anything. You just want to dance. Okay? Good night.
So things are going pretty well, don't you think, Bob?
Yeah, we got some calls. Let's see if this is Wayne or Dave.
Hello.
Hello.
Hi. You've been waiting a while, but you ready? Hello.
Hello there.
Yeah.
I can only hear you if I turn out my radio.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. That's the way. Unfortunately, the telephone is not wired into the board. You'll have to keep your radio on.
Okay, I'll do that.
Well, thanks for turning up your radio, because sometimes we have problems where the person is trying to hear us and doesn't know to turn up the radio. The subgenius will finally turn up the radio, even though it doesn't seem. It's like when they broke the sound barrier. They pushed the joystick forward in the wrong direction and they broke the barrier. So you did it.
We've broken the sound barrier.
Yes.
Yes, I'm calling about Thomas Brigham. Have you heard of Thomas Brigham?
Oh, no. Come on, man. You brought him up about 6 months ago. This stupid guy in Saskatchewan thinks he's Jesus, right?
No, no, no.
Thank God. Okay, who is he?
No, Thomas Brigham.
Who is he?
Found guilty of 3 counts of first-degree murder in the 1984 Labor Day bombing of Montreal's main
road. Oh, this is Greg?
Yeah.
Okay, we got a subgenius, a great follower of Dave Emery, Nip Tuck here. I'm sorry I didn't get back to you on that, Greg. That's a very interesting fact. Hey, tell the people what it is.
Well, I'll just read this newspaper article.
Yeah.
Shall I?
Yeah.
Thomas Brigham was found guilty yesterday of 3 counts of first-degree murder in the 1984 Labor Day bombing of Montreal's main railway station, in which 3 French tourists were killed and 47 other people were injured. The 6-man, 6-woman jury delivered their verdict after deliberating for 10 hours. Mr. Brigham, a U.S. pilot during the Second World War, smiled, stood and leaned against the prisoner's box before giving a 5-minute speech to the court after the verdict was announced. I appreciate the great difficulty it has been for the jury, court, police, and the media to understand what happened, he said. I don't want the jury to feel bad about its decision because it doesn't really matter. Mr. Justice Charles Felin of Quebec Superior Court sentenced Mr. Brigham to the mandatory term of life imprisonment with no eligibility for parole for 25 years. Throughout the 2-week test trial, the court heard testimony from 31 witnesses, some of whom said they had met Mr. Brigham on a train traveling between Montreal and Sainte-Foy, Quebec. The witnesses said Mr. Brigham, 69, had talked at length about numerology, spirituality, and the end of the papacy. 2 witnesses testified Mr. Brigham told them Pope John Paul would never make it to Montreal for his visit.
He was right. He didn't make it.
Scheduled to begin on the Labor Day weekend. Witnesses also said he told them, if you hear of an explosion, you will know it was me. This is his second trial in connection with the explosion that rocketed a heavy metal locker over a distance of 37 meters and left a hole in the concrete floor of the railway station 60 centimeters across and 3 centimeters deep. At his first trial, Mr. Brigham, a drifter, was convicted and sentenced to life in prison. Last June, the Quebec Court of Appeal ordered a new trial, citing 4 errors made by the presiding judge. Mr. Brigham, a father of 11, no wonder he wanted the end of the papacy, huh?
You only got half of 22, Dan.
Whose marriage ended in divorce after 28 years, has been serving his sentence in the Pinal Institute for the Criminally Insane in Montreal. He told the court he has been doing a lot of writing in Pinal and said, quote, the documents go to the White House, the Vatican, and Ottawa, end quote. He also spoke about his family and his days during the war as a fighter pilot.
Okay, now, Greg, why don't you get to the explosive fact that you found, and you can take credit for it. You found
this. I've got one paragraph here to go.
Oh, okay.
None of us really have any final control over our lives, he said.
That's true.
Don't think I'm a kook, because the Holy Spirit moves through all of us. Well, the explosive fact is here that...
Lead into it slowly, Greg.
Okay, I will.
Explain what the Torbit, you know, the Torbit document.
The Torbit document.
Yeah.
Well, the Torbit document was... something that was offered on a chap named Bob Marshall. He has a show on Sunday mornings called The International Connection.
Yeah, we work with him.
And he, during fundraising, and if you donate enough money, he will Xerox or copy this Torbit document, which he's told me was he got through Mae Brussels.
Yeah.
And it goes... literally naming names of who killed Kennedy.
Yeah.
And, I just happened to find this newspaper article, which I clipped out. I don't know when it's from. It's at least a year old, I think.
I mean, you found it a year ago.
I found it a year ago.
And that's when they were telling what he's been doing since he was in prison, right?
Uh-huh. And yeah. I just clipped it out because I thought it's kind of a strange article, right, just on its own.
And then you started looking through the Torbit document again.
Well, you sent me the Torbit, or you didn't send me, but Bob Marshall sent me the...
a couple months ago.
Yeah. And so I've been reading that lately, and then I cleaned out my office, and I have a rather large collection of newspaper articles and of strange things like this. And I pulled this out, and I thought, gee, this name looks familiar. You know, this looks awfully familiar. So I thought... I'll go back to that Torbit document, because I've been seeing Ray Cohn's name around lately. Roy Cohn.
Yeah.
He's in the document. So I thought, this name, Thomas Brigham, sounds familiar. So I go through, and I think, well, yeah, I won't find anything, but I'll look through. Well, there's a Thomas Beckham in there. And sure enough, there's even a picture of him. And you know what? He looks exactly like this guy. Okay? And
that's amazing.
And the picture, incidentally, is of... there's very few pictures in this Torbit document, but it's of three men being led from Dealey Plaza, the three drifters, or hobos. And now, there are three guys there, and they name names in the document of who these people are, or who they're suspected of being.
Yeah.
And, you know, any one of the three guys could be Thomas Beckham, but it just so happened to be the guy that looks identical to this guy, Thomas Brigham, who's in this newspaper article, and the resemblance is uncanny, let me tell you.
That's amazing. See, but that's the kind of ongoing making process of understanding, groping towards the answer, is that we needed someone like you. I mean, many people have read the Torbit document in the research field, but you read it again. You had it before, but then you read it again, and then it synchronizes with this other article. I mean, that's like a 10 million to 1 opportunity, and
it
happened. Because... you know, Dave Emery may not be reading about this guy in Montreal. Skolnick may not be. At the same time, they're reading the Torbit document. And so this is a sign of creative mentation that I was talking to the previous caller, is that you're matching and making. You're retrieving, going over the same points over and over again in depth, and there's always something new that'll come up that'll take you back to the beginning, to the origins.
It's pathetic almost, isn't it?
It's pathetic?
Yeah. No, no, it is.
Only when you're tired.
It's mentational.
Yeah, it's pathetic. It's not pathetic. It's, what is it? What are you really trying to say?
Well, it's, I'm not sure what I'm really trying to say. No, but I just was shocked, I think, by making the even so tenuous, perhaps, a connection. But now I'm interested in who this guy is up there and what he knows.
Okay, what you do is...
and what caused his divorce. But,
well, he's 69 in 85 or so.
Yep, so he was about 43.
And he looks about 43 in that picture of the document, which came out in 63, you know, during the Kennedy assassination.
Definitely, receding hairline, almost identical.
About 40.
Yeah, yeah.
And but you're saying the picture you have now is of him older, but he still looks like the guy 20 years ago.
He is tilting his head in exactly the same way. I mean, it is amazing. The whole structure of his head, his the hairline, you can say is, you know, 20 years hence what would happen. His nose is the same. I mean, it's a pretty bad Xerox, too. I'd love to get a better copy of that picture. I think that would help, but it's his eyebrow, like his whole facial construction is identical, and the way he holds his head, it's amazing. I don't know whether any connection here has really been made, but
no one's ever connected that I've heard of. In the
I'd forgotten about. I didn't even remember it happened. This whole railway bombing in Montreal. I don't even remember it.
Well, like this goes back to the theme of the program. Did you hear the beginning where we're talking about Mehmet Ali Agha shooting Pope on May 13th?
Yeah.
You got these lower down guys who were programmed to do this. Now the Rockefeller or the murder of Kennedy a long time ago. You got a lot of people who were part of that drifting around, still acting out whatever the effects were that they were programmed to participate in. And so this guy shows up, you know, blowing up in Montreal. And Montreal is a significant place. That's where Permandex was headquartered.
Mr. Bloomfield,
right.
Yeah.
The late Major Bloomfield, who died in 84. Maybe Brigham got to him. Maybe he covered it up with the explosion. But it's also interesting that you have Mark Lapine coming out of Montreal. Remember, that's where the heavy CIA mind control of the Allen Memorial Institute happened in the 60s, right?
Mm-hmm.
Dr. Ewan Cameron. So Montreal has a lot of history of the old power structure back in the 60s. And I don't think it's something important. Well, I won't say that. Montreal was still there. But it's interesting that a guy who blows up something there...
An American fighter pilot.
Yeah, goes back to the Kennedy assassination, which was when Montreal was important during the years of the Kennedy regime.
And getting back to old General Noriega today, I was prompted to phone to the Pinks today doing a radio broadcast.
You can phone anybody if you do that. Hey, just pick up the phone book, call a number, you'll get a Pink. Not
the,
their fault, though.
The Pinks were, it was in WBN, WBN AM in the United States. I was trying to find out some information about the Noriega thing, albeit bad information generally from,
but you need information.
From AM radio, but, you know, any little bits and pieces. And I just had, you know, the Americans were, you know, going on about how great it was that they'd gone in, and I just had to say something, you know. So I phoned, and they gave me a minute, and I mentioned that old Noriega was on the CIA payroll. The guy who was moderating the program didn't want to hear that.
Yeah.
And I was immediately taken off the air. And then later on in the day, there was a guy who you might be interested in hearing about. He phoned and said that he had been trying to get out to the media about this a CIA document that I don't remember the whole story, but it was a guy who said the family of the man who died in the plane crash, the one who Noriega took over from.
Yeah.
And he said that there was a CIA document that he's been trying to get out to the media that showed how the CIA had arranged to plant a bomb on the plane.
Yeah, the author, Graham Greene, the famous novelist,
yes.
He wrote a book about his friendship with that man. I think his name was Torrijos
right.
or something.
Exactly.
Yeah, and Beter mentioned that he was kicked out, or I don't know if it was him. He said in the tape that he was forced to the president was forced to resign in 82 in Panama. Now, of course, Torrijos wasn't forced to resign, so... The succession of leaders has been very violent in Panama, and yes, what you're talking about, there is lots of information available on the murder of him, and there's been successive murders since the late 70s in that area of the leaders, and I guess Noriega fit the bill for what they wanted to achieve later, which is happening now.
Yeah.
Though Noriega refutes that. You know, I don't know.
Refutes which?
He refutes the image they have of him. And he can convince people if he has personal contact with them. We've got proof here, documentation. People went down there, these congressmen, American congressmen. Now, maybe they're Pinks. They went down there, and they had face-to-face contact with Noriega, and they were turned around about it and decided and came back to Congress, Andy Bush, and his policy towards Noriega. So there's some kind of charisma the guy has in person.
Yeah, they were talking about that a bit on the television tonight on the Journal. They had a guy on there, and suddenly the tone of the broadcast went decidedly anti-Bush, and this man just kept bringing up all the, you know, CIA payoffs.
Is that right?
Yeah, and he brought up that Poindexter had gone down there in late 85 and talked with Noriega and said that he had to support the guy that's now in, that they installed today, and that he had to lead the a frontal attack against Nicaragua and so on and so forth and started dictating to Noriega. I guess you don't dictate to a dictator, and especially when you're Poindexter, right?
Yeah.
That was the beginning of the turnaround there, because Noriega didn't want to do any of that. And he said that on the Journal tonight to Nancy Wilson, of all people.
Where's Barbara right now?
I don't know where Barbara is, but this Nancy Wilson's a pretty good looker, you know.
Hey, come on now. That's just chauvinist. Come on now. I'm a woman, eh? I take that personally.
We may have to,
yeah. I mean, don't get fooled by the meat we left there for the dog, the watchdog of the mind.
Yeah.
Don't get fooled by the meat.
I know. It's anyway, this guy was on, and he just kept...
So he turned it around. See, it's easy to shape consciousness, you know?
That's
it's
right.
Just a matter of giving someone airtime, right?
You know? At the beginning of the newscast, they were saying more or less it was, the Americans had nothing to do with it, and they didn't have anything to do with Noriega, and they didn't put him there, and they didn't want anything to do with him, and then by the end of it, they were
convinced
right
they did.
Around the other side, and Nancy Wilson was attacking this former aide as they started to discuss the legality of it. They had one guy who'd worked with Carter and one guy who'd worked with Ford, and the guy with Ford, of course, was saying that it was totally legal, and they were in there protecting the canal, and then the other guy was saying, no, that it wasn't that, and Nancy Wilson was looking pretty skeptically towards the guy, towards the Ford guy. So.
Within the last couple of months, also, they've changed laws so that the FBI can go into other countries without that country's permission.
Yes, I saw that.
And either A, eliminate, or B, apprehend people who are wanted by American justice.
Yeah, I've heard that they're doing that. I don't know where I read this, but they're trying to do that so that they can instill in the American public the need to do it domestically, and which may be what you're going to have on later, that kind of...
Yeah, we're going to have that on later, maybe around 2:15.
Yeah.
So, Greg,
yeah.
I want to thank you for that fact. I haven't talked to...
I'm going to send it to Bob Marshall at the station. And,
okay.
And so that he too can see it. And
send it to Nancy, too.
Yes.
Well. Thank you.
Drop it up and put it up on the CBC bulletin board there.
Yeah, they'll appreciate that.
They'll hear this, what, Kennedy says, what, Ted Kennedy was shot? You know. They have no memory there. They're not allowed to.
Well, I heard also that the real scoop about the Kennedy assassination will come to the fore next year.
Yeah, I was telling that on the show here a couple of weeks ago. I don't know. Did Bob Marshall tell you that?
Yes, he did.
Yeah. Well, you know, I keep mupping things, and this is the year, and they're going to blame the Teamsters. So this will cause a lot of consternation and confusion.
A lot of union difficulties.
Okay, Greg. Okay. Listen, Dave Neufeld, everybody out there who reads the Torbert document are amazed by what you came up with. That is an amazing matching and making of facts.
Well,
I mean, in the Torbert document, those names, they have the various characters, they have various names. They all are variations on a couple of syllables. Well, this... Beckham and Brigham are similar. That's good enough. They play with the syllables.
Yeah.
It's Finnegan's Wake. Okay, thanks, Greg.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
We don't have any more calls at the moment, Bob.
Okay, let's take a break. Why don't we have a subgenius? I have an interesting little tape. This is get into the festive mood. Let's have a tape of a subgenius confronting Noam Chomsky about the Kennedy assassination, since we're talking about the Kennedy assassination.
Will it come out what side Chomsky is on? Because I've heard some of the stuff Chomsky has said about the assassination.
You want us to tell you what's on the tape ahead of time?
Well, no.
First of all, it's side
A. We might want to, like...
No, I'm not going to say nothing.
Side A.
You got side A.
Well, it says number one right at the front.
Yeah, it doesn't have Chomsky's name on it.
It's got Lud Arbonz, the bad things happen to good people.
Yeah,
bad
okay.
Things happen to good people.
That's it. Now that, we're going to play a short encounter taped in 1985 between subgenius Lud Arbonz, and he brought in Noam Chomsky into the Boston area to speak with a group of people, and Lud was just waiting to nail him. So let's see how Lud gets Chomsky here.
Okay.
You have to remember that the people in power never get tired. They never get tired. They're always at it. You know, they don't burn out. They always keep on. They learn, you know, they learn more and so on. Well, you know, other people have to be the same if they want anything to change. And there's no secret, you know, there's no secret. Everybody knows the answer. It's a very big commitment to be, say, a full-time organizer. Or, say, to be somebody working full-time at South End Press, right? It's a big commitment. You know, it's a commitment of a big piece of your life. It means you can't live a normal life if you're a movement organizer. Well, you know, if people want to undertake, and there are lesser commitments that people can be engaged in. If enough people are willing to do those things at whatever level there is, yeah, there can be change. If they're not willing to do it, there won't be.
Is there any relationship to the Kennedy assassination?
Let's not start that. No, I don't want to start in the Kennedy.
Is that laughable?
It's not laughable. It's just, look, whoever assassinated Kennedy, we're never going to find out.
What?
And it's because it's too deep a conspiracy. If it was a conspiracy, which it may be, it's too high up for us to penetrate. And besides, I really don't think it's important to tell you the truth. I quite honestly don't. No, I don't think it's important.
Why is it not important?
Look, thousands of people get murdered all the time. One of them was John F. Kennedy, and I don't see why he's more important than the other. Okay.
Intervention in Vietnam and Central America, Parallels and Differences, a talk by Noam Chomsky. My name is Scott Rover. I'm with the Harvard Radcliffe Committee on Central America. The Committee on Central America, or COCA, is an organization of Harvard Radcliffe graduates and undergraduates concerned with social and political and economic issues in Central America and the role of the United States in the region. We're involved in educational activities such as this, designed to increase people's awareness.
Why bad things happen to good people. The people who laughed about the murder of your president, who thought it unimportant, trivial, weren't fascists or even neoconservatives, but liberals, leftists, good people, intelligent people, many of them intellectual, certainly the caring, most sensitive and aware of all ages in the academic community comprising Boston and Cambridge, Massachusetts, in March of 1985. They'd come to hear their political leader, an intellectual hero, Noam Chomsky, the pioneering linguist turned political scientist and activist, a secure tenured professor permanently ensconced in that bastion of free inquiry and scientific truth, MIT, the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. That good people don't exercise their inherent powers of judgment and prefer to be led by a Judas goat because it's easier, safer, and less troublesome is at the heart of the problem. While Chomsky indefatigably attacks the nameless military-industrial complex, national security state, or what have you, his main mission, it appears, is to spread dis and misinformation about John F. Kennedy. The most blatant glitch in the false reality program you've been loaded with. John F. Kennedy, his work, and his fake. Exposing himself as a fraud and an agent of the oligarchy, Chomsky, to those with the slightest sense of morality and history, also see his secondary mission is to channel possible opponents of the criminal plutocracy in the vital academic community into safe, approved forms of dissidence so that these bright and valuable workers for the new world order can at once feel their righteousness while working for the one peaceful world of their controllers. True Orwellian doublethink. Listen to America's most prestigious Kennedy basher at work.
Once unleashed by the American organized attack in South Vietnam. Well, the government we'd installed to carry out this attack and to block the political agreements, it quickly began to collapse as soon as resistance began. And Kennedy then had a problem, and it's important to realize how he handled it. This is one of the dissimilarities between Vietnam and El Salvador and Central America, to which I'll return. In 1961 and 62, Kennedy simply launched a war against South Vietnam. That is, in 1961 and 62, the American Air Force began extensive bombing and defoliation in South Vietnam, aimed primarily against the rural areas where about 85% of the population lived. This was part of a program designed to drive about... Pardon? It was a program designed to drive several million people to concentration camps that we called strategic hamlets, where they would be surrounded by armed guards and barbed wire and protected, as we put it, protected from the guerrillas who we conceded they were supporting. Well, that was 1961 and 1962. That's what we call aggression or armed attack or something when some other country does it. We call it defense when we do it. This was when the defense of South Vietnam escalated by this attack in 1961-62. But that again failed. The resistance increased. And by 1965, the United States was compelled to move.
Go directly to jail. Do not pass go. Do not collect $200. Chomsky jumps from 1962 to 1965 without so much as a hint about National Security Action Memorandum number 273, issued immediately after Kennedy's murder. Chomsky purposely neglects to include any reference to President Kennedy's well-documented plans to pull our forces out of Vietnam, the action that certainly sealed his death warrant. If it had not already been sealed because of his growing awareness of the magnitude of what he had been elected to. Chomsky, as facile a sophist as he is a brilliant linguist, they only recruit the best and the brightest, slides that right past his dim-witted audience who get precisely what they came to receive. Absolution. Absolution for Kennedy's death. An absolution for themselves as collaborators with the criminals who assassinated him. You can tell by their inappropriate laughter when Noam Chomsky belittles the significance of the most telling event of the 20th century. Nip Tuck of Emory and Tuck, the research broadcasting team, from their archival program, Guns of November, Part 3, Vietnam and Watergate's relationship to the assassination of John Fitzgerald Kennedy.
Reading again from Peter Dale Scott's essay, The Kennedy Assassination in the Vietnam War. This is from the book, The Assassination.
Okay, that was subgenius. Lud Aaron getting a chance to air his opinion of Noam Chomsky in relation to the Kennedy assassination. And as you notice, he ends off with where he goes into Emory and Tuck. And we've played that segment thanks to Bob Marshall's show. He has featured that whole discussion, which is very interesting. Peter Dale Scott is a great researcher, and he has unlocked the meaning of those memoranda that Lud Aaron's just mentioned. So that's a little relaxation. Let's have some callers, 595-1478. We don't want to think about the implications of what Lud came up with. Let's try to escape it as soon as possible. I have some files here we can read about heaven.
So guess, basically, we got Gnome.
Hey, good. The other some teachers, they've fallen right
because
in.
Because I find
what'd
so
you say about Gnome? What?
About Gnome. Gnome is like the CKLN of MIT.
Yep, he's well-funded.
He's well-funded, okay. Hello.
See, Kellen isn't.
Hello?
Hi.
Whoa.
Hello, can hardly hear you.
Well, you're going to have to turn up your radio because we don't come through the telephone.
I did.
Can you hear it yourself now? Can you hear us?
I can barely hear you. I'm just going to ask my question.
Okay.
Okay.
Don't you want to hear your answer?
Well, turn the radio up. You can't turn it up. Okay, go ahead.
All right. You're slack when it's over, Bob.
Thank you.
What I'm calling about is your doppelganger who hangs out in that station aired some material concerning AIDS with a badly disguised person ponying up, with his voice badly electronically disguised, ponying up some theory about the origin of AIDS and about it being... developed as being some kind of incapacitating weapon, and he made some predictions about stuff that would be showing up in the pink media concerning people in the scientific community claiming to have been able to make an artificial AIDS virus and claiming to have pointed up a treatment. I was wondering what you thought about that, given this most recent report of some guy who got a bone marrow transplant and after that AIDS miraculously had disappeared from his body.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, because I got the radio on now, so I can hear you fine.
Yeah, say that again. What's this about a bone marrow? I didn't hear that.
You didn't hear what the story was. This is some guy who had AIDS. He was given a bone marrow transplant, and it took care of the AIDS. He was AIDS-free.
Because it was in the bone?
I'm not sure about the... Well, I don't know much about the virus, yada, yada.
Yeah.
But he had AIDS. He was given a bone marrow transplant. And after that, he no longer had AIDS. The reason why they know this for sure is because he died a couple months later from other problems, right? And on autopsy, he was found to be free of AIDS. I was wondering how this relates to this anonymous person's theory, because one of the things he predicted is that someone would very soon have pony up an alleged workable treatment for this.
What he predicted was...
I thought that's what he said.
On that particular tape presented by Bob Marshall, he did predict that certain powerful institutions would announce that they have created the AIDS virus.
Right.
They have manufactured, I guess, an artificial form of the original AIDS virus. That was the major prediction that would point to the truth of his pattern, and that hasn't been announced completely yet, but it was announced before the broadcast. It was in October, Connaught Lab. You still there?
Yep.
Yeah, did you hear about Connaught Labs announced that they had made a successful fake AIDS virus in October?
No, I didn't hear that.
Okay, then that was announced in October by Connaught Labs, and then National Health Group, the former Fort Detrick Biochemical Research Center, I think it's called the National Health Institute. They,
NIH, right?
Yeah, they said that they were working on the same task and were going to probably be able to announce the same thing that Connaught Labs did. Now, to me, that's very close to what Bob Marshall's source said, that they will announce publicly, I guess, through 1990, I mean, not until far off in the future, that they have successfully manufactured the AIDS virus. And they will do this, they said, because they want to find out how to cure it. They got to manufacture it, see how it works, and laboratory manufacture, see how it works, and then they can have some keys to how to combat the original virus. Now, my source, or Bob Marshall's source, said that the reason this will be done by an international power was they want to cover up the fact that they did originally make it years ago and let it loose as an experiment in Africa. So they want to cover, they want that not to be referred to. They want to claim that they did it for health reasons, for solving the problem of the original virus. So it's interesting that the Connaught Lab is the ones who did this, and they've been a battle field for various big corporate media groups wanting to take it over. Now, it's interesting that you have Ciba Geigy and a Swiss company had came up to compete with the takeover bid by a company in France. Now, according to Dr. Beter, France is Bolshevik-controlled. I don't know. That was in 1982. I don't know if it still is. The thing is that you have the French faction and then the Ciba Geigy, which is maybe IG Farben, which goes back to the Rockefeller cartel, the old Rockefeller German cartel. So it seemed like, if you want to put it in simple terms, that the Rockefeller faction was trying to compete with the Bolshevik faction out of France to take over this lab, because maybe it's necessary to have control of it to deal with impending discoveries.
Now, what's
my drift?
What would be the role of AIDS in the domination of the Pinks, would you say? Or what purpose is it serving?
The same purpose as stirring up a civil war and revolution in Central America is to lower the population of the planet. That is the specific goals of the oligarchs, and it's spelled out as a kind of a platform in the Global 2000 document drawn up for the presidency of Jimmy Carter in 1980, is that there's a huge faction historically of oligarchs who believe there are too many people on the planet. So they want to get rid of them via disease, plague, famine, war, and revolution, and poverty. So,
do you buy that personally?
Now, Bob here doesn't have a point of view, but between you and me, yeah, I buy that.
What do you...
But that's off the record, okay?
Okay.
You deny it if anybody asks you if I said that. You deny it, right?
Oh, of course. I mean, I'm going to deny that this conversation ever took place.
Thank you.
Smart person.
But don't you think that it perhaps serves some other, perhaps even more important purpose? Because once you scare the shit out of everybody with all of these things, it's a lot easier.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Now, in major
to put chains on them.
Oh, yeah, yeah. It includes many audiences. The top-down oligarchs, they design their models of consciousness shaping, and they accomplish many things with a major conspiracy. They accomplish many things with the Kennedy assassination. They accomplish many things with the Pan M103 explosion. The AIDS design accomplishes incredible stuff on the military level. They can't move into hardware and nuclear and neutron bomb wars. The new form of warfare is biological warfare. That's been a fact for 15 years. And the secret elites will continue exploring the possibilities. And they may be justified, not from my point of view, but from the pink prison point of view, and they're the majority on this planet, they may be justified in protecting themselves because they don't know if another group is doing research. That's why technological development is inevitable. It has to be done.
Well, tell me, who's pulling their strings? Besides you, but I'm not talking about that far up the line.
Yeah. Who's pulling the AIDS virus manufacturers?
No, who's pulling the strings of the oligarchs who are supposedly running this branch of the show?
Well, the lower down levels, it's Satan. And then below that, it's the vampire astral entities, which live off blood. And then you move into the physical domain, you look to the... let's say the people who have the most prestige beyond wealth. Well, how could you have prestige if you have if it doesn't include wealth? It would be historical. So you must have some historical